All right. Okay, so today we're going to talk a little bit about our work, and we're going to introduce it with a little bit of discussion about background and the diagnoses of MDS and AML. And I hope at the end of this section, you'll appreciate that I view these diseases as sort of an overlapping spectrum, and I hope you'll be convinced of that. And then we'll talk a little bit about the work that Mike and I do together to bring some of our science to patients in the clinic. So we do sort of truly bench-to-bedside collaborative research. So myelodysplasia and acute myeloid leukemia are two diseases associated with bone marrow failure. All of us are born with a small number or with a certain number of stem cells. Those stem cells are made in the embryonic kidney and moved to the bone marrow during embryogenesis. And they set up shop there, and those cells live with you your whole life. They divide relatively infrequently, and they make all the red cells, white cells, and platelets that you have in your body. Red cells are turned over every 120 days. White cells, like neutrophils, turn over about every 9 to 12 days, and platelets turn over every 7 to 10 days. And you can appreciate that the entirety of the blood system, therefore, turns over in relatively frequent fashion. The stem cells that are born with you and live with you your whole life are subject to all of the things that you see in your life. So if you inhale a snootful of exhaust from a car, or you refinish the wall with a paint that has benzene in it, your stem cells have the potential to be exposed to that toxin. And what we now know is that patients with aging can develop mutational events in their stem cell pool that are the same mutational events that we see in patients with malignancy, with MDS and AML. And we believe that the fact is that these mutations probably, when more than one of them accumulates, can give rise to this malignancy. And so these two diseases have an overlapping clinical presentation. Patients often present with fatigue, with infections, with bleeding, and with low or high white blood cell counts. For MDS, we know that prognostically significant information includes things like age, the performance status, or the ability of the person to live their life and do everything that they're doing. In MDS, we consider the degree of cytopenia, so how low are their counts, and how transfusion dependent are they, because the more transfusion dependent they are, the more low their platelet count is, the more likely they are to die of a bleeding-related complication. We arbitrarily place a cutoff of 20% blasts in the bone marrow, such that if you have a patient who has dysplasia in the marrow or funky-looking cells in the marrow who's had low blood counts for a long, long time, if you do a bone marrow biopsy and you see 20% of the cells are young, even if the background looks similar to a patient with MDS, that patient is still classified as AML. Frequently in these patients, we see cytogenetic abnormalities, including deletions with chromosome 5 or 7, or complex karyotype with very many translocations, as Anne-Marie talked about. And these mutational events are associated with a poor prognosis in MDS. Median survival for patients with high-grade MDS is extraordinarily poor, in the order of about 6 months. Elderly AML presents in a similar fashion, and again, similar prognostic features are important for this disease, things like age, performance status, a similar cytogenetic risk category, deletion 5, deletion 7, and complex. These are all considered poor risk features. We frequently see in older patients that these patients have an antecedent clinical history that's consistent with a prior diagnosis of myelodysplasia. And again, median survival is relatively short, especially in patients who have secondary leukemias. So you can see here the incidence of MDS as a function of age. Again, this is considered a rare disorder, but it's substantially more frequent in patients with aging. And actually, as you look at patients in terms of mutational profile in the peripheral blood, what you see is, in fact, this age distribution for MDS is entirely overlapping with the age distribution at which you begin to see clonal hematopoiesis, even in people without hematologic malignancy, suggesting that this is probably a field effect related to age. You can see here survival for patients older than 60 years old with a diagnosis of MDS based on what the traditional prognostic scoring system assessment. This is a group of patients who are in the original prognostic scoring system for MDS, and you can see their distribution in terms of low, intermediate 1, and intermediate 2, and high-risk disease. These designations are made based on, as we described before, clinical characteristics such as age, cytogenetic risk profile, blast percentage in the marrow, and degree of cytopenia. You can see here the incidence of AML as a function of age. And again, I hope you can appreciate that this is a really largely overlapping graph where you can see a substantially increased incidence in this diagnosis with aging. And again, I think that what this reflects is, in fact, the MDS AML population rather than de novo AML. Outcomes in patients older than 60 who are considered the old with AML are actually relatively poor and have largely been unchanged for many years. And you can see here more recent data suggests that a slightly better prognosis, but overall still relatively poor. You can see 5-year survival is less than 25%. So a standard approach, a standard approach for patients who are older who have MDS and AML are treatment with the drugs azacitidine and decitabine. These drugs are analogs of the DNA building block C. They get incorporated in place of C, and there they do a couple of different things. These drugs are known to prolong survival, but they take many months to work. So unlike traditional chemotherapeutics, where we give a napalm-like chemotherapy, we hope to wipe out the disease, and then we allow the cells to grow back, with azacitidine and decitabine, we give the drugs over at low dose over many cycles, and we see a slow response to treatment. The mechanism of action for these drugs is actually still a matter of some controversy. And in fact, historically, we believe that they worked by re-expression of epigenetically silenced tumor suppressor genes. There's some data to suggest that they do have a direct cytotoxic effect because they cause double-strand DNA breaks. But we, in our group, are particularly interested in the question of whether or not these drugs are actually modulating the immune response to cancer. As you may recall, normal cells are characterized by hypermethylated pericentromeric chromatin and hypomethylation of CpG islands, particularly in the region of tumor suppressor gene promoters. In the case of cancer, you can see dysregulation of this normal methylation pattern such that the pericentromeric chromatin regions and global methylation patterns can become hypomethylated with hypermethylation of CpG island promoter regions, resulting in transcriptional repression and loss of some tumor suppressor genes. And by the same token, hypomethylation of these pericentromeric chromatin and repetitive line elements can result in mitotic recombination and genomic instability. The drugs, decitabine and azacitidine, which are HMA drugs, as I said before, look exactly like 2-deoxycitidine, but are substituted at the 5' position of the carbon ring with nitrogen, which does not allow them to accept a methylation modification here. The result is that when DNA methyltransferases, DNMT3A, 3B, DNMT1, perhaps DNMT3L, bind to methylated parent strands of DNA and try to copy the methyl phenotype to the daughter strand, they are unable to do so, and so this results in a suicide substrate. This becomes a suicide substrate for DNMT, and you get intracellular depletion of DNMT enzymes. And with progressive rounds of DNA replication, you can have re-expression of methylated genes, and this can happen recurrently. Prior to the era of HMAs, we used to treat all patients with AML and even those people with MDS with cytotoxic chemotherapy. As I mentioned before, this napalm-like approach where we gave these very highly cytotoxic drugs, 7+3 cytarabine and daunorubicin, over 7 days. And the goal here was to sort of kill off anything that was growing relatively rapidly. The downside of this approach is that therapy is extraordinarily toxic. The patients have to stay in the hospital for greater than a month. They result in really profound cytopenias, and patients have a high rate of infection. And for people, particularly older people, actually induction failure is relatively high, with rates of induction failure as high as 50 or even 60%. Historically, some patients received low-dose cytarabine as a temporizing measure with the idea of sort of cutting the grass of the leukemia. Response rates were relatively poor, and in patients with complex karyotype or poor-risk cytogenetics, responses were less than 5%. The advantage of this approach is that it's outpatient, but unfortunately most patients, even those who responded, responses were of relatively short duration. And then a mainstay of our therapeutics is actually supportive care, including hydroxyurea to manage leukocytosis, transfusion support, and antibiotics, which can actually prolong patient survival, but doesn't do anything for the underlying activity of the disease. With the advent of azacitidine for treatment of patients with secondary acute myeloid leukemia or with hypomethylating agents, What you can see here is outcomes can actually be substantially improved. And this is a study that was very famous, published in JCO in 2010, based on a previous paper published in The Lancet Oncology in 2009, in which they took patients presenting with what was described as high-grade myelodysplastic syndrome, and a percentage of these patients were recharacterized as having AML when retrospectively evaluated. And the patients were randomized by the treating physician to receive either the clinical trial therapy, which in this case was azacitidine, or what was deemed at the time standard of care, so 7 plus 3 high-dose chemotherapy like napalm, low-dose cytarabine, or best supportive care only. And then the patients were then randomized within these three groups to receive either the investigator's choice of therapy or the azacitidine. What you can see here is that those patients within this cohort of MDS patients who were later recharacterized as having AML, there are about 55 patients in the AZA group and 58 people in the conventional care regimen group. The overall survival is actually superior for patients receiving AZA compared with these conventional care regimens lumped as a single thing, as a single group. And this speaks probably to the lesser toxicity of azacitidine, as well as to the potentially higher activity in these patients. You can see here survival for patients treated with decitabine. This is the other hypomethylating agent, just for the sake of comparison. Because of the interest in using these drugs, in patients deemed unfit for induction therapy, there's a study published by Bill Bloom, which has now become really a standard reference for us, in which patients received, instead of the usual 5-day course of decitabine, they received a 10-day course of decitabine. And in this group of patients, again, a relatively small group of 53 patients, they offered patients 10 days of decitabine at their institution, and they saw an overall response rate of actually 63%. At the same institution, their historical response rate to 7 plus 3, and these were truly AML patients, their historical response rate to 7 plus 3 in this group was about 50%. And if you then take a look at those people within the complex karyotype group or those with monosomy 7, these are patients who historically have responded extraordinarily poorly to induction therapy, their response rates are actually really substantially high, suggesting that perhaps these drugs are working in a substantially different fashion and with slightly better response. Very recently, in fact, in December of this past year, a publication from the group at the University of Washington, St. Louis, published their single-agent retrospective assessment of a group of patients receiving decitabine 10-day regimen for either MDS or AML. And within their group, they looked at molecular characterization of the disease, and what they found was within the group of patients who had TP53 mutations, historically the worst of the worst, whose outcomes are extraordinarily poor, in fact, they saw 100% response rate to decitabine. And I think what this speaks to is the distinct potential paradigm for response in this group of patients. Overall, there were 99 patients in this cohort, and by mutational analysis, 21 of the 21 patients they looked at had a response to decitabine, versus those with other mutations, they saw only 32 patients out of 78 patients. So our hypothesis, and I just touching back on this, P53 mutated patients tend to have genomic instability and tend to have a relatively more complex karyotype. In other diseases, it's felt that complex karyotype results in enhanced presentation of neoantigens and potentially enhanced recognition by tumor by the immune system. And so our hypothesis based on all this data is that, in fact, perhaps anti-MDS-directed T-cell immunity of CD4 and CD8 class may contribute to the clinical response to hypomethylating agents that we observed in patients with myeloid malignancy. And this would hang together very nicely with our results observed with TP53 mutant patients. So we know that patients with MDS, especially patients with low-grade MDS, who have evidence of autoimmunity, tend to have lower-risk disease and a lower degree of progression. We talked before about patients with more aggressive disease, MDS, who have a lower survival, but there are a large percentage of patients with MDS who have low-risk disease, and many of these people have an overrepresentation of autoimmunity. For those patients with higher risk disease who require treatment with an HMA because of cytopenias or because of sequelae of the disease, only about 50% of patients respond. And within those responses, we see about 15% of people get a complete remission, that is to say, normalization of the hemoglobin, normalization of the platelet count, and normalization of the neutrophil count with a decreasing blast in the marrow to less than 5%. But a large percentage of patients have a hematologic improvement. And in fact, within the context of treatment with an HMA, any hematologic improvement is known to correlate with actually an improved survival. What's interesting is that although we've been looking for many, many years to find evidence to suggest that our hypothesis about the mechanism of action of these drugs, that is to say, hypomethylation of specific tumor suppressor genes, we hypothesized that that was the mechanism of their action, we have actually not been able to validate that. So despite the fact that we see hypomethylation of tumor suppressor genes and we see reinduction of these activities, none of those reinduced genes seem to correlate with response to therapy. And although we also hypothesize that maybe cytotoxicity might be playing a role as well, we haven't been able to prove that this is true either. We know for sure that cell cycling seems to be required, so that's not surprising, right? These are S-phase specific agents. They have to be incorporated to be active, but we don't know why. So with this in mind, we began to look at a class of genes called cancer germline antigens. There are 150 of these genes. They are both X-linked and autosomal. They are known to be expressed in the embryonic ovary and the adult testis. But in extra embryonic ovary and adult testis tissues, they are generally hypermethylated and silenced. We know that in solid tumors, these genes are sometimes overexpressed just by the fact that the whole of the tumor itself is hypomethylated. And when they're hypomethylated and expressed, we know that there can be anti-tumor immunity that can arise spontaneously, and that this anti-tumor immunity and infiltration with T cells recognizing these cancer testis antigens is associated with a more indolent clinical course. There have been a variety, based on this data, of vaccine studies targeting these agents, things like MAGE-A3 in lung and NY-01 in ovary, and these clinical trials have suggested that it is possible to enhance this anti-tumor immunity. We also know that in patients whose tumors escape, often what escapes is actually NY-01 or MAGE-A3 silent disease, suggesting that in fact that our anti-tumor immunity might be having a pressure effect on the cell differentiation. In myeloid cancer, we know that these genes are actually not expressed routinely. So there have been extensive characterization of a variety of different myeloid malignancies, both AML and MDS. And in a majority of these malignancies, in fact, there is no expression of NY-01 or MAGE or any of these others. And this is likely due to dense hypermethylation of these antigen promoters. But we also know that treatment with hypomethylating drugs is a standard of care in these diseases, and it might be possible to reinduce expression of the NY-01 or other cancer-testis antigen genes using our standard approach. So based on this observation and our knowledge that in solid tumors it's possible to treat with hypomethylating agent and re-express the genes, we at Roswell started collecting patient samples from people receiving standard of care hypomethylating agents. And so Mike and I proceeded to do some studies, which Mike will share with you.
These are a series of patients, all of which had AML, and all of which were selected for the site of beam therapy based on their performance characteristics. So these are the data that are in the paper that we provided to you, and for the next few slides we'll just kind of go over those results. So these were, so these were all patients that were myeloid cells circulating in the periphery were selected, their DNA were isolated, and the first question we wished to address was, does the cytobine result in global hypomethylation? And the assay we use to test this is pyrosequencing, which is a way to quantify specific methylation at the CpG residues. And what we used was line 1, which is a repeat element that just goes across the whole genome. And this is a surrogate for global DNA hypomethylation. And all of these samples were isolated during the first cycle of decitabine. Usually this drug is given for a period when you're basically on treatment, then followed by several weeks off treatment, then on treatment, off treatment. And all the data we're going to share today are from that first cycle. So this is a cohort of about 20-odd AML patients all receiving the drug, and what we saw was a significant decrease in global DNA hypomethylation. That's, of course, sort of a control response. And as we go over time, so what this was is all the patient samples taken before the start of treatment. And then what we were able to do was, depending on sample availability, we just binned them into different time periods, days 1 to 5, 6 to 10, 11 to 15, and 15 plus, all in the first cycle. And again, you can see that there's a nice hypomethylation across the entire genome. And this is what you would expect to see. So we then wish to address whether or not we could see specific induction of one of our cancer testis antigens. And in the supplemental data to that paper, we actually looked at a variety of cancer testis antigens. And throughout that paper, we actually looked at a few in greater detail, along with NY-ESO-1. But for the purposes of this lecture, we are just focusing on these results today. And that, again, using chiral sequencing to quantify DNA methylation, again, pre-decitabine pre-treatment, we saw around about average about 90% methylation, which is in keeping with the known DNA hypermethylation of this cancer testis antigen. We treat patients getting the decitabine. We see overwhelming DNA hypomethylation. And this was taken at what we call the DNA methylation nadir. So this is actually across all time points for the purposes of this graph. Of course, if you expect to see DNA hypomethylation at a gene promoter, you would expect to see then a co-committant increase in gene expression. And that's why we see here, and these are samples all taken at the same time points. Again, pre-decitabine, pre-treatment, this is undetectable amounts of NY-ESO-1 gene expression by quantitative RT-PCR. And what we saw was, again, we saw detectable levels of NY-ESO-1 expression in the majority of samples. But you can still see here, appreciate from the y-axis, is that, again, it's across a very wide range of scale. So some patients induced expression pretty quickly and fairly robustly, others less so. Again, going back to that same graph with the DNA hypomethylation, again, global level, at specific time points, again, we saw that with some patients, differential responses in terms of their kinetics to the drug, in terms of DNA methylation, and of course, in terms of gene expression as well, that some patients gave you nice, strong responses early on, and then some other patients took a while. And in the graph from that paper, we selected three patients, and each one of those patients had a different kinetics of gene induction. But really, what's kind of really important for all of this stuff is that if we wanted to use this clinically, as Elizabeth has mentioned, that there are responders and non-responders. And if the responders were the only ones that showed NY-ESO-1 induction, it's perhaps a nice biomarker. It's perhaps gets the overall hypothesis of the immune system. But it's not usable as a target in immunotherapy, such as those are being developed here at Roswell Park. And so what we did was we analyzed both our clinical responders and non-responders. And for this purpose, this clinical responder was any patient that showed hematologic improvement, as Elizabeth mentioned earlier. And we broke this up about 15%, it was about 7 out of 22 patients showed a clinical response. So we were a shade under 33%. 6 of the 7 clinical responders showed induction of NY-ESO-1 gene expression, which which is an expected prediction based on the idea that, of course, the DNA, the drug is getting into the DNA. It's demethylating the DNA. You're getting the co-committant increase in gene expression. But what was also interesting is that in the clinical non-responders, we still saw induction of gene expression in, again, the majority of the patients. And this gets to those points that Elizabeth raised earlier, is that we really don't know why people respond to the decitabine, and that it has really nothing to do with the molecular response to the drug, and that you have the majority of these patients showed a molecular response. But even with that, several of the patients did not show a clinical response. And this is why this is such an active field of research in leukemias, because this drug, when it does work, does have a significant survival benefit. And so understanding the mechanisms by which you have these patients respond molecularly but not clinically is a very significant one in the field. What is possible is that what we have not been able to really demonstrate here, so one, on this graph, we're now breaking up into the responders versus the non-responders, because one question we did want to get at is this, are some of these differences due to methylation? And so on the y-axis here is, we just graphed it as delta methylation, so this is basically the pre-decitabine sample minus the sample taken post-decitabine at each one of these time points. Of course, there are no error bars here with a sample of, unfortunately, one. So, in this one patient here, we saw that there, you know, regrettably, I guess it's 1-6. But, it, you know, this patient still didn't show very robust DNA methylation. And same thing down here is that we're, again, Some of these samples are just as equivalent loss of DNA methylation, but for the most part, they're averaging a bit higher. And so it looks to be, at least at this gene level, even though all of these patients show kind of a similar molecular response across global DNA hypomethylation, at this specific gene, at the NY-ESO-1, the induction of gene expression is tied pretty nicely to DNA methylation. And this might be where some of the field is kind of going with not only with decitabine, but also some of these epigenetic drugs that are coming online for AML, is that it's not necessarily global changes that really matter, but it ends up being a bit more, is there a subset of genes whose alteration of their chromatin structure and subsequent gene induction, is that what really matters? And to date, for DNA methylation, even though that's been part of the hypothesis, no one has tested it, but it's still a formally possible outcome. So one of the things to walk you through this slide is the idea that if you're inducing gene expression of an antigen, the question was, is that antigen expressed at a degree where a T cell can recognize it? So to just sort of walk you through this experiment, over here, just for reminder, were four patients that we selected for further analysis. And you can see here the pre-decitabine induction of gene expression, so the pre-decitabine level of NY-ESO-1 expression, and the post-decitabine levels. All four of these patients showed an increase, with patient one, the only one that showed a background. So in this assay, what we were able to do is all of these patients have the same HLA haplotype. So as best as we can tell, that's all the major histocompatibility complex. And so all these patients have, you know, as for the purposes of this assay, can recognize the same immune response. And what we did was, in this experiment, is we have, from previous work with Konya Dunsey's group, is they have a T-cell clone that is antigen-specific for NY-ESO-1, and is also HLA-compatible with these patients. So basically, when these patients express NY-ESO-1, and they present it using their MHC class molecule, that can be recognized by the T cells and no others. And so we did a series of experiments to demonstrate that this is specific to NY-ESO-1 antigen expression. But what we then can do is you can mix these T cells with these patient cells. So this is basically a reagent that's constant across all these graphs. And when you mix these together, what you do is the antigen that's being presented by these cells is recognized by the T cell receptor that's specific for that antigen on these cells, and that triggers a response in the T cells that mimics what you would see in a cytotoxic T cell response. So what we're looking at here are the first steps that sort of arm this T cell to then go on and kill these target cells. For the purposes of this experiment, we actually did not look at the ability of these T cells to, in fact, kill these cells. We just looked at these early responses. And these responses include the production of the cytokines interferon gamma, or interferon gamma, tumor necrosis factor alpha, and interleukin 2. These are expression of these cytokines by T cells. All are part of the activation of a cytotoxic program. And that's what the CD107 molecule is also. It's a marker of T cell degranulation. Basically, what happens is a CD8 positive T cell has granules that have that are packed full of molecules that go on to kill any target cell, and this is a marker of that of those granules, degranulation basically. And so these are three markers of cytokine production, and this is a marker of sort of the T cell getting primed to kill the target cells. And for three of our four patients, what you'd expect to see is that NY-ESO-1 expression is increased. And you're incubating it with an NY-ESO-1 specific T cell that compared to post-decitabine, compared to pre-decitabine, you would expect to see an induction of all these signals. And in these three patients, all of which kind of showed induction of NY-ESO-1 expression, you kind of see a significant, not statistically significant, but a noticeable increase in the expansion, the expression of all these cytotoxic T cell markers, with the highest response with this patient here, which is not surprising considering this was the biggest magnitude of induction of NY-ESO-1 expression, as well as the highest overall value. And with this patient, where there wasn't much of a difference at the very beginning, we didn't see much of a difference or between pre and post-decitabine. So the importance of this is that even though we're detecting by qPCR vanishingly low levels of the RNA, that RNA is being turned into protein at a level which you're getting expression of this antigen at a level which can be recognized by a cytotoxic T cell. So that's kind of, again, the take home for this retrospective cohort conclusion, is that NY-ESO-1 expression induced in the circulating blasts from patients getting decitabine. And what I should note at this point, again, this is an important point in the paper, is that, as Elizabeth mentioned earlier, that leukemia and MDS is, you know, a fairly, the disease itself can be pretty heterogeneous. And so what we were able to do is demonstrate not only in overall myeloid cells did we see induction of NY-ESO-1, but when we further selected for myeloid cells that have a phenotype that would be more representative of hematopoietic stem or progenitor cells and therefore mimic leukemia blasts, that we also saw induced NY-ESO-1 expression. And that the expression of the protein, protein expression and subsequent antigen presentation was sufficient to trigger a cytotoxic response in a very specific NY-ESO-1 T cell. So that has kind of led to a clinical trial being developed combining decitabine and NY-ESO-1 vaccination in patients with MDS or low blast count AML. And this is sort of was the study schema, and we'll go over this over the next slide, but this is the vaccine approach that we're going to use. And then this was given to patients. The patients then received decitabine for a cycle. About at the end of this, they got another vaccine, and then subsequent cycles of decitabine. So you really did get a sequence of vaccine and then decitabine, the idea being the decitabine turns on NY-ESO-1 gene expression, and then, of course, by vaccinating the patient against that antigen, you prime the immune system to remove those malignant cells. So, again, I apologize for probably going to more immunology than you bargained for this, but to kind of get at this vaccine, that's a very clever approach. So what it does is it combines a full-length NY-ESO-1 protein combined to an antibody that recognizes the DEC205 receptor. So the importance for this part is that it is, as I mentioned earlier, the HLA haplotype of a specific person is really critical for T cell recognition. And by using a full-length protein, the full-length protein will get processed by the cell and it will get presented in the context of the HLA. And by using a full-length protein, it just doesn't matter what the HLA. It's HLA unrestricted, and therefore it can be used in any patient, depending on, you know, regardless of their haplotype. What DEC205 is, so DEC205 is a receptor that's present on antigen-presenting cells. And so this is a monoclonal antibody to this receptor. So what will happen is that any cell that is used to present antigen, it will take up this combination, it will chop up the full-length NY-ESO-1, it will present the NY-ESO-1 protein. It will then, by presenting the NY-ESO-1 protein to the T cells in the lymph node, it will arm a series of T cells who will then expand a bit. They will differentiate. They will become hopefully memory cells, and they will then, like any vaccine, they will then be able to become armed and activated when they survey any NY-ESO-1 expressing cells after the decitabine treatment, such as what will happen in our patients. And the elegant thing about this approach is that phase 1 data in the expressing solid tumors from Kunle Odunsi's work here, it's well tolerated, and you get nice NY-ESO-1 specific responses. So we know the vaccine is going to work in terms of the technology. And what this is given with is the adjuvant to any vaccine, because if you just give a vaccine in the absence of adjuvant, what that means is that you basically trick the immune system into thinking that self, you tolerize that your system against the antigen, you won't arm an immune response to subsequent antigen. And so that's what this is that poly-ICLC it's a double-stranded RNA, and what it does is it tricks your immune system into thinking it's being infected by a virus. And when that happens, is it activates an immune response. And that immune response, basically, in the combination of this immune response activation combined with this, is able to activate generate an immune response against this protein that then the T cells then recognize as a foreign invader, and therefore in subsequent exposure to this, the T cells will then be able to recognize them and activate a cytotoxic response, which is the goal. So we've done this study. We've done this in 9 patients. And so this is being an active field of research. And so basically what we want to do is make sure, first of all, of course, it's safe. What we wanted to do is make sure that what we saw in our big group of AML patients was reproducible in our MDS patients. And finally, to look at the immune responses after vaccination. So to sum up, 9 patients with MDS, median age of 64, were enrolled. There was no, the safety cohort of 6 patients complete without unexpected toxicity. And so the adverse events were mostly related to either the cytopenia treatment or the disease, which are, you know, cytopenias, not surprisingly. Any sort of chemotherapy drug that you're giving to actively cycling cells tends to hit tissues that are that have a certain amount of proliferation to it, which of course includes the blood system, even under normal conditions. And some of these other adverse effects that are related to disease or to cytopenia. We had 2 patients withdrew from the study early due to adverse effects. 1 patient developed a myocardial infarction, and 1 patient suffered a terminal hemorrhage due to thrombocytopenia, and that was the cytopenia. That was the cytopenia related, because of course, the cytopenia, as I said, is a cytopenic, is a drug that can induce cytopenia, can induce things like, again, thrombocytopenia, which basically reduce numbers of platelets. Again, kind of going over the cohorts, 9 patients, 64 age, evenly split. 3 of 7 had MDS, and 2 had low blast count AML. So here are the results. So this is all unpublished work. And so what we were able to do for this is, rather than that first study, which was just looking at that first cycle of the cytobine, we plan this to induce a series of, look at a series of events throughout the entire course of treatment. And so this is percentage methylation. And down here is looking at pre-decitabine and then during different cycles of treatment. So C1 is cycle one. Again, because of sample availability, whenever we can get samples from the patients, we bin them under different time points. But essentially, you know, cycle one, day 410 is really early on in therapy. Cycle four, day 21 to 26 is at the end of the study. Line one, the marker of global DNA hypomethylation. You can see again, pre-decitabine is around 80-ish%. It's like getting the drug, goes down. Then it starts to, as you get further and further and further away from that cycle, it goes up again, not surprisingly, because you've lost the drug and so you're getting remethylation. Next, you start the next cycle, it goes down and up, down, up, et cetera, et cetera. And so the black bar is myeloid cells, so these are purified cells. So we know we're looking at what is the disease-related fraction. Interestingly, what we also did is we looked at plasma for cell-free DNA, and that kind of mimicked the exact same effect. And this is actually a very nice result because this will allow us in the future to look at this sort of readout without without using our very valuable cells for this analysis. We can just look at the plasma DNA. NYS1, same thing. You know, it goes down, comes back up, down, up, down, and kind of follows again the same kinetics you'd expect to see with a drug where it's your on cycle, then off, on, off, etc. So that mimics what we saw in the replicates what we saw in the AML patients. So what this is then we did the same thing looking at NYX1 expression. So what we did is we summed up, just to sum up, all these data are in a table. The black bar represents a time point where we saw NYX1 expression. A gray bar is where no expression was detected, and white represents not done. Depending again on sample availability, when the patients went off study, or we just didn't have enough material at that time point. So these are the nine patients. Pre-diagnosis, only one patient showed NYS1 expression. But what you can appreciate from this table is that during cycle one, the majority of patients showed induction of NYS1 expression, co-committent with NYS1 demethylation. Cycle two, few perhaps a bit less, and then what you can really see at cycle four here at the end, that a couple patients, like patient two, patient nine, and even patient seven, showed that nice, you know, it's off, comes on, probably a bit off, and then comes on, then we have a bit of a gap here, but then it comes on, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So this is showing, dovetails really nicely with our methylation data. Again, with the cytobine, you know, you have your drug is off, it gets demethylated, expression turns on, but then eventually the drug goes away, so it goes off, and then it's cycling, goes out throughout the study. So to kind of just walk you through the immune responses, so we looked at three things, the generation of NYX1 specific antibodies and the antibody titer. None of the patients had a titer before vaccination. Only two patients, patients two and nine, which were part of those nice expressing patients, showed a good antibody response. This was the same assay we used kind of a bit earlier, where we were able to generate T cells that had they were NYC1 specific and started to express cytokine. In this case, it was interferon gamma that showed an antigen specific response to NYC1. Again, patient two, not surprisingly, showed the highest expression of CD4 lymphocytes. Patient nine, again, nice robust production of antibody, high levels of CD4, and even higher levels of the cytotoxic CD8 cells. So you can see from this is that some patients responded nicely, but others did not. They had very low levels of T-cell responses, and we'll get into perhaps one of the reasons why this is in the next few slides, but this is sort of an active field, an active area of research, is figuring out why some patients were able to induce a very strong antigen-specific response post-vaccination, whereas other patients were not, even though their gene expression pattern would have suggested they were good candidates. And mostly just kind of sum up the clinical characteristics and the response to therapy. Again, so patient is over here, diagnosis is here, and so what all of this alphabet soup of acronyms are different subtypes of MDS. So, and The important thing for this is to look at this right here. So IPSS-R is basically a prognostic score based on a number of parameters. So very high means basically the probability that this disease will transform to AML. So in this nomenclature, very high is a poor prognosis. High is, you know, is you're getting is median, and intermediate is sort of in this group is the lowest risk of transforming to AML. In this scoring system, there are low to very low, and those patients are actually at this point treated almost entirely differently with a different set of agents. So what we've got here is karyotypes. Again, one of the things that is sort of difficult about, it's very challenging about treating MDS and AML is that the karyotype can be completely different. In fact, the gene mutation spectrum can be completely different. You have these four patients here with very complex, large, you know, greater than three abnormalities. But these five patients right here, by the cytogenetics, they look normal. And in fact, this one patient here was the one that we observed died from or succumbed to progression of their disease. And what current is being done in the clinic here is to take these patients and to send them out to sequencing, because there was that slide you may recall, you know, from a few several minutes ago where Elizabeth mentioned how the P53 mutation dictated the response to decitabine. All of those genes on that list are shown to be mutated in MDS and AML. And in fact, a standard part of the diagnostic today is to sequence for all of those mutations. Because for drugs like decitabine and the induction chemotherapy, they're nonspecific. We just give them to any patients based on their performance characteristics. But the hope is in the future is that they will be targeted therapies for those specific mutations. And some of those targeted therapies are actually here being tested in clinical trials here at Roswell Park, whereas others are still in the preclinical stages. But what you can kind of see here is that, again, there's no type, I mean, as high as you can get with a cohort of nine, is that the response doesn't necessarily, doesn't translate to the prognosis. So, for example, this patient right here showed a complete response, and it was a complete response that actually went on to an allogeneic bone marrow transplant in an effort to cure the disease due to their age, and they actually got graft versus host disease. So this was they succumbed to something that was completely independent of their disease. And then you have a patient here who went on to die from AML progression, showed no response. And then some series of patients here. You have two patients here who are in complete remission who are just getting maintained on decitabine. Because when you give people decitabine, you pretty much give it until they don't show a response anymore. Because the drug is relatively non-toxic. And if the performance characteristics bear out, you're just on the drug almost indefinitely. So even here you can appreciate amongst a small cohort that there isn't necessarily a tight correlation between what their prognosis is, what their outcomes are. But one of the things we're very interested in is continuing to monitor these patients that are still alive and seeing, you know, especially these patients right here where we can track to see, you know, can we pluck out antigen-specific cells because they haven't received a transplant. Their immune system, therefore, is intact just as the way it was before decitabine treatment. And so this is a very active area of research is to see whether or not this vaccination approach has resulted in a truly generation of a memory response long after this trial has ended in terms of the intervention. So kind of, again, just to sum up, you know, the combination was well tolerated. Our results in terms of hypomethylation and subsequent gene expression were the same in our AML samples and in our patients receiving the treatment. We were able to develop some immune responses, but even though some of the responses were above background, some of them were barely above background. And so the responses were also less robust than observed in solid tumor patients, and so as with every other cancer today, you have to now look at the combination with checkpoint inhibitors. So there is actually a rationale for doing that in AML and in MDS. It's not just, you know, doing it because it was on the cover of Science a few years ago that it was hot and therefore you should get on the bandwagon. We went back to our original AML population that we studied, and this actually is in the supplemental data of the OncoTarget paper, that we just looked at PD-L1. So PD-L1 is a ligand that's expressed on cells, on antigen-presenting cells, and on cancer cells. And what it does is PD-L1, when it binds to PD-1, the receptor on the T cell, it basically shuts down the T cell. And this is a mechanism against the immune system being activated in response to deal with infections. It's the mechanism by which you shut down your immune system. What cancer has been able to do is to constitutively activate this response. So what we did is by flow cytometry, we looked in a variety of our patients, and we were able to look at the blast on flow cytometry. And originally a paper had come out of MD Anderson suggesting that the cytobine induced expression of PD-L1 on the blast. And so that could be, you know, a really important result, because of course if you, first of all, in general, if you think you want to generate an anti-tumor response but the drug you're using is inducing the expression of these inhibitory genes, you would want to know that. And also in the context of a vaccine strategy, again, if you're doing something that's turning on something to inhibit a T-cell response, that's something that has to be accounted for. So first, what we did observe is that across of our patients, again, we saw a kind of heterogeneous expression of PD-L1. It did not in any patient, except for maybe this patient here, show real significant or robust induction after the cytobine treatment, which is good, but it is on in the majority of the patients, and we don't. And for example, it is entirely possible that even at this lower level, this is at being expressed at a level sufficient enough to turn off a T cell response. So this is sort of one point of rationale for why you want to include maybe potentially a PD-1 inhibitor, which are being tested in the clinic nowadays, and are FDA approved. In the context of AML and in MDS. And the other side of that is, of course, the PD-1 promoter is actually regulated by DNA methylation. And what we've observed and other groups have reported on is, again, you're getting in T cells, either the bulk T cells or even in specific T cell populations, we were able to observe that at the site of, you know, before treatment, you know, we got variable methylation of the PD-1 promoter. But after the cytobine, they showed hypomethylation. And what we're currently doing is doing work to correlate this decrease in methylation with increase in PD-1 expression. Again, this is a very important point, because if your decitabine is doing something that's perhaps inhibiting an anti-tumor immune response, we have to take care of that, and that's kind of getting to where our next direction is to combine the safety of nivolumab, which is a PD-1 inhibitor, checkpoint inhibitor, in combination again with our decitabine and NY-ESO-1 vaccination. And the idea being that if we go back to that original graph with those 9 patients, some of those patients that show a fairly minimal above background response to the vaccine, that maybe if by incorporating this immune checkpoint inhibitor in there as well, we can boost up their T cell anti-tumor response. And so this is just to kind of get at what the study will be. Is that nivolumab, you know, just to kind of say decitabine and the vaccine, this is the exact same schema that we did in our earlier trials, but now we're just throwing in the nivolumab. And to kind of just go through this, you know, again, looking at the same thing, the idea of correlates in terms of immune correlates, making sure that we see gene expression of NY-ESO-1 in combination with hypomethylation. We see antigen-specific responses. And for this trial, you know, we're going to increase the size of the patient cohort, so hopefully we'll be able to correlate this with some outcomes. That's something, you know, with the sample size of 9 in our earlier group. We weren't able to do so. So the eligibility of this, again, will be newly diagnosed MDS, low blast count AML, and non-transplant eligible, because, again, one of the confounding factors from our previous trial is that some of those patients went on to bone marrow transplant, and of course, once they go into bone marrow transplant, you cannot really ask any questions of the immune system at that point. So again, what the study objectives will be is evaluating the safety, looking for our molecular epigenetic response and assess the immune response. As I said earlier, this time we're going to really focus on whether or not we're improving the response rate or, in fact, overall survival. So I think with that, this was probably sorry for all the immunology, but we would be happy to take any general questions about NDS or AML or about some of the specific data that in the studies we're currently doing here at Roswell.
I have a question about the slide where you show the effect of T cells when YSO1 was expression was upregulated.
So this guy?
Yeah. Okay. So these TDA cells are supposed to be specific against NYSO1.
Yep.
So how come there's already a response when there's no NYSO1 being expressed?
Right. So that is probably due to background and non-specific staining. Non-specific. That's a non-specific response. What we could do, what we plan to do in the future, is to address that question. Let me show you. So, say this guy right here. There's two possibilities. Either, first of all, you actually do have a level of NYSO1 expression that is below the detection threshold, and that's what's inducing it. So actually, there is some NYSO1 specificity here. To test for a non-specific response, what we could also do is throw in just an excess of NYSO1 peptide, kind of as a cold competitor, and if this still stays the same response, but this drops down to the same level, we know there's some non-specificity. But if we do that and both of these go down to zero, then we know that there's probably some level of induction of expression here that we're not detecting in our quantitative PCR. So we basically, a cold competitor is probably the way to go to rule out specificity versus non-specificity. So that's what a future experiment. Yeah, the importance of that has been brought to our attention, so we're going to be doing that. All right. No. Oh, yeah. Right. So, I'll blow. Yes.
There were five vaccines, and there were four rounds of the cytokine.
Right.
And we did that in order to look at the vaccine-only response, so in the absence of the cytokine, to see if there was any, if we could observe any antigenic response or anti-ELISA response or anti-NYSO1 ELISA specificity prior to the exposure with the cytokine. And in fact, when we looked at that, we didn't see any. So just giving the vaccine itself did not, with one cycle, did not appear to induce NYSO1 immune response, either at the T cell level or at the antibody level.
Yeah, and we give it to multiple sites, right?
Yeah, so the way the vaccines are administered, and this is true for a majority of the cancer vaccines are given in serial lymph node basins. So they do one arm to go to one draining lymph node area, they go to a second arm to go to the second draining lymph node area, they get one in each thigh, and then they get one in the belly. And the idea there is to expose a maximum number of draining lymph nodes to the vaccine, so as to recruit the largest possible repertoire of different T cells. Okay, any other questions?
Yeah.